Hey guys, my name is Emily. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for having me to introduce Anna. You know, I was thinking about one thing, which is when you come into this program, I think especially like when you're new, it's a bit overwhelming. You meet a lot of different people. You form relationships with a lot of different people. And if you stick around long enough, I mean, reality is that sometimes that group dwindles and it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And then you have those people that are like your people. You know what I mean? And Anna is one of those people that is like my people. You know, this woman never ceases to amaze me. She, no matter what she goes through, she continues to fight. She's been one of the best friends that I've ever had. She's worked in recovery for quite a few years since she's been so, I mean, way after she got sober, she's been working in recovery. And to see just what she does on a day-to-day basis for Alcoholics Anonymous, for her friendships, you know, she always shows up. She's one of those people that when you need her, she's there. She shows up, you know. And I consider her one of my very, very best friends, and I love her dearly. She means a whole lot to me, and I'm really excited to hear what you have to say tonight. So with that, I give you guys Anna.
Hi, I'm Anna, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Anna.
Jerry, thank you for asking me to speak. It's actually very interesting how this came to be. I went up to 8111, and I hadn't been to 8111 in a long time. It had actually been years since I'd been to 8111, and I was up there with a friend, and we were just doing some step work with two new girls that are in a sober living residence, and I wasn't really paying much attention to my cell phone or anything, and we were sitting there, and I get up, and Jerry walks up, and I was like, oh, hey, you know, whatever, and he was like, did you get my text message? And I was like, your text message? I haven't talked to Jerry since I worked for him. You know, I worked as a hostess after I had about maybe 6 months fresh out of treatment. I worked at a hostess at this restaurant for about a year. It was the first job that I had in recovery, and I hadn't seen him in years, and he asked me if I would tell my story. And I've always wanted to tell my story at this meeting. I picked up my first year chip at this meeting. I got sober at this meeting. I've been coming here for 5 years now. I got 5 years on Monday. So I'll be blessed enough to pick it up, you know, at this meeting where I picked up 1 year. I remember the woman that was speaking that night. I remember how many people were here. Lindsay was the one who gave me my chip. She's my sponsor. So I'm just very, very grateful to be here. I have no idea what's going to come out of my mouth. It's typically one of those things that you don't know how to prepare for. Generally, like a rule of thumb for people like us is I feel like we typically like to be the center of attention and very much enjoy talking about ourselves. So it's usually not that much of an issue, you know, to be able to get up here. And I'm very grateful that the meeting's a little bit smaller because, you know, this past week has been very interesting. It really has been. And even as I was like sitting and reflecting on this past week, every single year since I've been sober, February, for whatever reason, like just disaster ensues. And it's just like the weirdest, most bizarre thing to me. But like Emily said, because of this program, you know, because of the women in my life, the men in my life, the fellowship, you know, what I've learned, this way of living and just adapting to what life throws at you because it's life and there's really not much you can do about it. I have very little control. I think the universe moves things in the way that they're supposed to move and I just have to be able to flow with it, and that's what this program has taught me to do, you know, to really be able to accept life on life's terms and to show up in a way of complete loving and tolerance for the ones around me and just be able to take responsibility for the part that I play, you know. This is the primary purpose group. I do absolutely suffer with, you know, other issues as well as alcoholism. So I'll try to keep it to, you know, a minimum just to be respectful, in terms of, you know, getting into any sort of detail about it. But, I'm 29 years old. I was born in October of 86, which means I'm going to be 30 this year. It was so funny, too, because, like, you know, I vape now, and it's so weird to go into, but because, like, you know, this, like, incident has happened this week, cigarettes are my go-to, you know, so I, like, go in to buy cigarettes, and the woman today was like, I thought your license said 96. And I was like, honey, I wish it said 96. I was like, I'm turning 30 this year. You know, good God. I grew up in Metro Atlanta. I grew up in East Cobb County, went to Lassiter High School. I don't know how familiar you guys are with the area. East Cobb snobs, you know, that's what we are. That's what we're known for. Emily, we went to school not too far away from me. And I have two wonderful, loving parents, Karen and Gary. They were here when I picked up my first chip. They are so phenomenal. They've been married 45 years, God knows how, especially with somebody like me, you know, and I'm really, and I know that I had a profound effect on their relationship. You know, in hindsight, you really, really do get to see, absorb, and understand that my behavior directly affects those around me. And not only does it affect those that are absolutely like in my life, it has a trickle effect. You know, it affects the people that are in their life, and that, you know, and I was able to see that, but they're very loving growing up, no problems, very supportive. Never did I ever want for anything. If I asked for something, it was given to me. I was never abused or neglected. I never experienced any sort of traumatic event growing up. I have an older brother. He's, you know, normal. And the truth is growing up, you would have like looked from the outside looking in, and my brother's behavior throughout school, because he struggled severely with things. And me, I was just a breeze. I mean, my parents talk about how my brother, you know, screamed and cried at night when he was a kid. And me, my first words were night, night. You know, I asked to go to sleep. That was my first word. Like, who does that? You know, I was just like this. I did very well academically. I was very social. I didn't have any of those issues. Me and him were polar opposites. He got arrested several times in high school. I never got arrested in high school. I got straight A's. He struggled to make a C average. I mean, you would have thought that he would have been the primary issue. Therefore, I really think that I was able to kind of skate under the radar when it came to things. And my parents really just never had to worry about me. I wasn't an issue. I wasn't a problem. I will say this, you know, the longer sober you get, you become aware of things and you really just reflect on how you were. You know, the whole point of coming up and speaking is, you know, it's sharing, you know, what it looked like for me. And it's not the what did it look like for me in terms of the drinking and substance use that ensued. It was just like how I behaved and how I perceived the external world, you know. Out here is reality. It's real. It's tangible. But in here, it will distort it every day. It will distort the littlest things. Somebody will say something to me, and I will take it and run with it. Somebody won't invite me somewhere, and I'm going to die alone. My boss wants to, you know, call me into my, Anna, can you come into my office? I need to talk to you. I'm getting fired, you know. Somebody at a meeting, I'm at a meeting and somebody like makes eye contact with me. Oh, they think that, they think I'm ugly. They think they're better than me. You know, they think these things, you know, and I will absolutely convince myself that that is true. And I will live my life by it, and I am absolutely driven by it. And I was driven that way when I was younger. I'm very clear I was driven that way. My primary issue when I was younger, before alcohol or drugs were ever introduced to my life, was you need to accept me at all costs, and I will do anything to make sure that you accept me, that you think that I'm perfect, that you think that I'm beautiful, that you think that I'm intelligent. I need you to be able to understand that these are the things that I am, and I'm willing to just do whatever I can for you to believe that to be true. Because I had no capacity to believe it of myself. And I don't know why that was. I have no idea. It's just the most bizarre thing, because my mom will even tell me growing up, and I remember this. Say my mom, you know, was berating me for something. I was bad or like, you know, I don't know, misbehaved. She would, you know, give me a hard time. And I would immediately start crying because, again, in my mind, if I'm getting a consequence for an action, for a behavior, and somebody's telling me something, my mind will automatically say, they do not love me. I am not loved. and I would immediately go up to my mom and hug her. I would just, like, I would grab her and hold on to her because I was like, I need that affirmation. I need to know that I'm loved. That's how I was. I mean, that's how I've been my whole life. I feel like even till this day, I have a very, very difficult time when people that I love have a problem with me, you know, and call it a character defect or call it admirable or whatever you want to call it, because I can take it to the extreme. I absolutely am capable of taking it to the extreme, but I really did have a very, very big problem if I thought you didn't like me or if I thought you didn't love me or think that I was wonderful. My alcoholism and my addiction ultimately just magnified those things, and the behaviors because of that just were, they were awful. I behaved awful. It just became more manipulative. So I had to be the best at everything. I remember in fifth grade, the first time that I remember it manifesting, we had like a you would run a mile or whatever, and everybody would do it. A kindergartner would do it up to fifth grade. Like, everybody would run this mile, boys and girls together, it didn't matter. Well, up until this point, I was always the best, and I took a lot of pride in that. I was one of the tallest girls. I was one of the first girls to be, like, the tallest when I was in kindergarten, which is weird because, yes, I'm wearing high heels, but I'm, like, 5'3", and I'm actually one of the shortest ones of my friends, I feel like. And I was the most athletic, you know. I was really good at softball. I was very athletically gifted. I was always the best in class. I always felt that I was the smartest. And the first time I ever saw somebody excel ahead of me was in that mile run when a boy passed me. And he's going to run faster than me, for God's sakes. You know, that's just like it's physics, like, or whatever. That's just what it's going to look like. And he passed me, and I'll never forget. Me and my self-pity and all of this stuff immediately fell to the ground in the most, like, dramatic fashion. Just like, oh my God, and, like, just started crying. Because I have to be number one. Because the belief system at that point in time was, if you are not number one, if you are not first, you are last, you are a loser, and nobody likes you. And I was absolutely convinced of that. And that's what drove me for years. It's what drove me until I was 24 years old. And it still, at times, has the ability to drive me today. You know, I've written several inventories and different types and personality types that, you know, create this ego that I have show up, you know, whether I think I'm the best employee or I'm the best girlfriend that anybody's ever had or any of those things. It shows up. So I took, well, I say this loosely. I guess the first time I got drunk, because I know I took a sip of wine or a sip of beer when I was younger than this, you know, just to see, like, what it tasted like. I got drunk for the first time when I was 14 years old. I remember everything about it, everything about it. My relationship with alcohol and other substances is just abnormal. I mean, the effect that it has on me, mind, body, and spirit is unlike anything I had ever experienced up until that point. You know, it completely shifts everything, mentally, physically, and spiritually. I mean, some people may look at me and be like, how could you say that? Like, but it's true. Because the way that this program works is, and based on these spiritual experiences that we have in this conscious contact with God, that's what fills me today. That's what gives me the ability to live and to be happy, joyous, and free, essentially, you know, and that's what I experienced the first time that I drank alcohol. It was a positive experience. I drank alcohol because, just like I said, I need to be accepted, and there was a group of people that I felt I needed to be accepted with, and they were drinking alcohol. It's as simple as that. I love working in the field of treatment. I really do, but there are some people that I come across, they're like, well, let's get down to, you know, your issues with your dad, and you know, this person has this, and it's not that's not necessarily the case. It is with some people, but not for me. For me, I drank because it seemed appealing, and I wanted to be a part of, and so I drank. And it was awesome. I didn't get too wasted. It was a positive experience. It made me present. This, all this that goes on up here, you know, it just stopped. I was able to just talk to people freely. I wasn't constantly obsessing about what they thought of me. I was just very confident, and I absolutely loved it. And I, of course, believed I was going to experience that again by drinking alcohol. And I did. I did not, go, fly off the handle those first few years of my drinking and experimenting with other substances. I didn't. It was not a negative experience. I think that if it was a negative experience for me at the time, probably wouldn't have continued to do it, but it was always a positive experience, and so I did it. On the weekends, it was when we could find it. There was really no other manipulative, tactics. The odd thing about somebody like me, too, is the fact that I, as far as I can see, I'm the only one of, me in my family. My parents they don't drink. They didn't keep alcohol in the house. And it's not because they're, devoutly religious or have, anything against it. They just, and, brace yourselves, they just don't like it. They just don't like the way it makes them feel. I mean, it's just my mom is the type of woman who's like, I've got a headache, and I just think a nice glass of Chardonnay would make that headache go away. She takes 3 sips and is like, I'm getting too hot, and sets it down. It doesn't make any sense to me, And my dad, in my 29 years of life, I think I've seen my father drink twice. And one of those times was simply because it was my brother's wedding and it was for a toast, they do not like the way alcohol makes them feel, so they do not drink it. And for somebody like me, it just, it doesn't make sense because it just, viewed as the elixir of life. It gave me life. It breathed life into me. And so, we're 14-year-old kids in 8th grade, and it just, whenever we could, I definitely always, you have that friend, and maybe you were that friend whose parent or had a parent who just was like, do whatever, I don't care what you do, come hang out, y'all stay up all night, y'all sneak out of the house, y'all don't sneak out of the house, y'all just walk out of the house, and I'll see you when I see you. And, that's usually how I tried to be able to do that, is finding friends that had those qualities and that had those accommodations for me, and that's just how I pulled it off. When I got into high school, I slowly but surely experimented with things. I don't know about other people's experience, but my experience with stuff like this, because originally I always knew 2 things about myself growing up. I knew I would drink alcohol because, quite frankly, when at my age, I know they don't do it anymore. It's not a thing anymore. Magazines, TV commercials, they advertised the hell out of alcohol and cigarettes. I knew I was going to smoke cigarettes, and I knew I was going to drink alcohol, and I just knew it. It looked sophisticated. It looked wonderful. It looked fun. So I just knew that that's what I was going to do. And I remember I drank alcohol. I'm never going to do this. I'm never going to smoke weed, for instance. Never going to do that. Sure enough, my experience with alcohol was so great. Let's try this out. Positive experience. All right, weed, not so bad, I will never do cocaine. I will never do it. Sure enough, start doing cocaine. Can honestly say, not a fan of cocaine, but if it was in front of me, I would do it, okay? Anything you could think of. Acid, mushrooms, ecstasy, all of those things, if it came about, I always had this firm resolution, this line drawn in the sand that says, I'm not going to do this. And if I do this, then it's going to look bad. I might have a problem. I had enough wherewithal with that information. But every single time I would do it, and it didn't kill me, because that was, if I snort cocaine, it's going to kill me. I've seen movies, and it's going to kill me. And when it didn't kill me, and when nothing bad happened, it's positive. I remember that. It's stored in my brain, and it's there forever, and that's just what I recollect. It changed. It altered the way that I felt. Again, mind, body, and spirit. It changed all of those things for me. And it alters it in a way that, creates this hopelessness within somebody like me. So I was talking to Lindsay about this earlier today. I got to spend a lot of time with her. I've been able to spend a lot of time with her recently, which I freaking love. But high school was great. It was great for me. You know, I drank on the weekends. I did smoke weed every single day, all day, every single day. But it was not unmanageable. I was making good grades. I wasn't necessarily lying to my parents by any means. I wasn't sneaking out of their house. But I was definitely doing things that they probably would not have been very proud of me for. I definitely was leading a life that they probably would have been shocked to hear that I was leading. But because I was making my commitments, because I was doing well in school, they never questioned me. Again, they never had an issue with me. My brother is getting arrested several times. He has all these issues. All this stuff is happening. And I'm just like, I'm just the golden child. And there's no problem. They don't even see it coming in any shape or form. Now, because, you know, of who I am, and again, like, I don't really know where this, I still haven't really quite been able to put like a finger on it in terms of just like looking at stuff and going through different bodies of work, and, you know, being sober. For whatever reason, I'm very, very, I put a lot of importance and a lot of my importance and self-worth based on men. I really do. It's definitely evolved. It looks different today than it did 5 years ago, than it looked 10 years ago. It looks very, very different, but there's a lot of emphasis on that. I almost used relationships as in the same way as I used substances, very much so. It was just as dark. It was just as depressing. It was just as unhealthy as anything else. I was in two long-term relationships throughout my drinking and using career. They were both 4 years long. I was in a relationship all through high school, and it was very emotionally, verbally, and physically abusing relationship. And the same resulted once I got into college. I was in a 4-year relationship, and it was the same thing. Very intense. Very, I guess, passionate, if that's what you want to, you know, call it. But it was very, well, I say that in terms of just, like, the fighting. Like, we constantly fought. We constantly used substances together. And I was no angel. I say that he was physically, verbally, and emotionally abusive, and I was too. You know, I would throw punches if I had to. You know, I would say things that, honestly, if anybody said those things that I said to me today, I would crumble before, like, right before you. You know, I would crumble to the ground. That's just the way that I behaved. But, you know, that's what it looked like for me. Unhealthy relationships. I need to be with them. I am nothing without them. Just that standard battered woman thing. I have a buddy that I worked with up at a treatment center. We shared an office together, and I'll never forget, like, sitting there with him and telling him, you know, I had forgiven so-and-so for, you know, the abuse before I forgave him for, you know, leaving me for another woman. You know, I like, seriously, forgave him for abuse before I forgave him for leaving me for another woman. That's where you see, like, where this takes you, where it takes your mind. And he just looked at me and he was like, that is so, like, an abused woman's stance for you to say something like that. That justification, that just, like, low self-worth and that low self-esteem. And I'm not even, like, awake to it. You know, I'm not even awake to just the distortion that my mind has created and the importance that I place on things externally that I believe need to define who I am as a person. If I don't have him, I have nothing, you know, and that's how I lived. And that's why I stayed in those relationships. I stayed in those relationships because that was the belief that drove it. If I do not have him, I have nothing. I might as well just be dead. And I believed to my core, you know. If I were to ever see a woman in the situation that I was in, I would just want to smack her, you know. I would want to smack her. But here I am, and I remember my parents looking at me and being like, what are you doing? We did not raise you this way. We did not raise you to allow men to treat you this way. We did not raise you. Like, what is your father? Like, no daddy issues here, you know? And that's what I'm facing. That's where this disease takes me. That's where that mind, body, and spirit thing, that's what it looks like. You know, that's what it did. So I got through high school. I graduated. I was able to get the Hope Scholarship, and I went to Georgia Southern. I also don't know if you guys know anything about Georgia Southern, but it's known for partying. There's not a whole lot down in Bullitt County. It's bars and booze. And my alcoholism manifested the minute I was a freshman in college. It went from weekends to weekends and Monday. It went from weekends and Monday to weekends, Monday and Tuesday. And then Thursday, we would slip Thursday in because there's no such thing as Friday anymore. Thursday is the new Friday, you know. That's what it looked like. And I was drinking every single night. And there would always be a reason to. And there would always be a reason for me not to, but then my mind would convince me that there was actually a reason. I really would, like, all day long, when you go through the big book and you read what they're saying in there, the things that I can identify with and hook up with when it comes to the way that I use substances, it was absolutely crystal clear. And mind you, when I came into this program and she took me through the book line by line, I feel like most people, like, there's one of two things happens with people when they actually go through the big book and they're in this desperate state of mind. And one is, fuck. So you're basically telling me that I'm screwed. And then I feel like the other, which is the category that I fall into, is I finally take a breath and understand what has been going on with me. That this, what I'm reading, what she's describing, the experience that she's sharing with me is, that's me. That's what this is. That's what I'm up against. That's what's been going on. That when I say to myself every morning when I wake up that you will not do this today, that it will not look like this today, that it will be different today, that you will get your life together today, and then whether it's 30 minutes, 2 hours, 5 hours, 12 hours later, and I am doing it again anyways. When I swore I would never do it again. And I made plenty of firm resolutions. There are plenty of firm resolutions. At the time, I may not have, like, really thought it was a firm resolution, but I made plenty of resolutions. I made plenty of, I'm not going to do this, and I did something different. And I was completely, completely oblivious and powerless to even understand. There's a part in the big book that says, you know, at a time, many of us would have been able to stop, you know, had we really been able to, like, take a look at it, we would have been able to stop this cycle or whatever. Now, some people, maybe not. I don't know. And I don't know what my experience would have looked like. But what I will tell you is that when my drinking increased to the point that I failed all of my classes my freshman year. I lost the Hope Scholarship. And my parents were just like, what the hell happened? I don't understand. Like, what is going on? That is when the idea that I was like, my alcohol is a problem, but other things aren't necessarily my problem. I could probably do other things. And that's what I did, you know. I became somebody from my freshman year of college to the age of 24 that hardly drew a sober breath. Hardly drew a sober breath. And if I wasn't sober, so to speak, or if I wasn't using, I was using means to help me not feel like I was going to die physically. So really never a sober breath from my freshman year until I was 24 years old. The progression of it in terms, and everybody in here knows what it looks like, you know, we all get it. If you're sitting here, it's not by like some mistake. I was talking to somebody that I worked with yesterday, and she's like, I mean, by the time people make it to our doors, it's not because they're just, like, having one too many drinks, you know. They make it to our doors because their life is completely falling apart. And whether they're awake enough to it or have experienced the suffering or have that moment of clarity or realization or whatever you want to call it, you know, and come to treatment or come to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, they are there because their life has been destroyed. Something isn't right. We don't know why. Sometimes people really seriously do have a hard time correlating their substance use with the behavior that they have. Or they only correlate that and are like, I'll just stop doing that and I'll be completely fine. Which another belief that was completely smashed when I walked through the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was completely convinced that if I stopped doing what I was doing, if I stopped using substances, that I'd be fine. It was just that simple. I just need to stop doing this, and I will be fine. There were several times in my 20s that I went to AA meetings and NA meetings. I couldn't tell you the first AA meeting I went to, probably because I was intoxicated when I went, and I probably because I had no intention of getting sober. I went because of the guy, because for whatever reason, bless my parents' hearts, you know, that's what us Southern people say when we're kind of like, you're kind of stupid for not, like, realizing it, you know. His parents just happened to be a lot more, you know, educated and experienced in this deal, and he'd been to treatment God knows how many times, whereas my parents just remained completely, like, blissfully ignorant to it. Or maybe not blissfully ignorant, they were just, we don't want to look at this. Or the age-old, like, Anna, you need to get your life together. I would get my life together for a short period of time, and then I would just go back, get them off my back. Fine, I'll do this, I'll do that. You want me to get a job? Cool. You want me to stop stealing money from you? Fine. You know, and I wouldn't do it for, like, 2-week periods. Like, it's cool. It's whatever, you know. You don't want the boyfriend to come over to the house anymore? Fine, I'll sneak him in. We're all good. Nobody's the wiser, and we're fine, you know. My attempts to avoid consequences just caused me to become more manipulative than I had ever been before. And unfortunately, my parents weren't at a place where they were able to really give me very many consequences. And I didn't experience very many consequences. You know, I think that it's not just like a, you know, random coincidence that I'm a woman in this program that's able to have an experience and share it with people and say, look, like, you don't have to go to jail. You don't have to lose every earthly possession you've ever had in your life in order to get this deal. You don't. You know, I didn't have to. I didn't lose very much when I got sober. I did not lose very much when, you know, when substances were removed from me, when that obsession to use was removed from me, when God entered into my life and the realization smacked me in my face that tomorrow when you wake up, it's going to look no different than it did the last 10 years of your life. It's going to look exactly the same. And in fact, it's going to kill you. It will kill you. You will do this until it kills you. And so I went to meetings here and there. Really no intention of getting sober. Then in 2010, what time is it? Oh, God. In 2010, it got bad. I stole a lot of stuff from my parents, a lot of things from my parents. I wrote many bad checks. I did a lot of, like, awful, awful things. I stole my parents' wedding bands, any jewelry, anything that was just, like, that you could hawk, like, whatever. I did it. I stole it. I hawked it. Whatever I could possibly muster. And honestly, like, I look back, and it's amazing because I always just, like, really, really do look at, like, how entitled and, like, lazy we can get as individuals, because best believe that when I was out there doing that, any links, the fact that I was literally, like, in the red most of the time, literally in the red, $250 in a negative bank account, but somehow could find a way to get money every single day blows my mind, because it's determination. I am willing to go to any lengths to do this. And I did it every single day. It was very, very rare that I wasn't able to pull that off. And if I wasn't able to pull it off, I would find somebody that was able to pull it off for me. And that's, I did it every single day. And so in 2010, things got really bad. The boyfriend went off to treatment, and he obviously was doing the deal and was listening to his sponsor, because one day, out of the blue, I heard nothing from him. Nothing. And now, at that point in time, I was utterly convinced that if he went off to treatment, that I would be able to myself get sober. That he was the problem, and that if, like, that problem just, like, kind of went away, that I would actually be able to. He was more seriously disturbed than I was. And I still think he might be more disturbed than I am, but that's fine, you know. That's neither here nor there. He's the problem. I'm not the problem. So he goes off to treatment, and, in fact, my use doubled. overnight doubled. It was twice as bad as it was before because now I didn't have somebody to share things with. And I don't share well with people. I don't. I don't understand people that would come up and be like, can I get a little... No. No, I'm the one licking the dollar bill after, like, this is what this looks like for me. No, you can't have this little, like, get out of here. You know, like, that doesn't make any sense to me, you know? We're people who, like, get in a car once it's 105 degrees outside, find the warm beer liquor bottle, and we chug it. Like, no, like, we don't do that, you know? It just, like, doesn't it make sense to me. And I have friends that, like, to them that are completely normal that I thought used the way that I used. Like, I look back in hindsight, and I'm like, they were nothing like me. They were really nothing like me. They, like, I'm seriously a disturbed person. And so he stopped talking to me, and that was the first time that I seriously wanted to get sober. I went to an AA clubhouse in Alpharetta. Why there, I couldn't tell you. I went there and I picked up a white chip, and of all the meetings that I had ever gone to, it was the one, and actually, y'all, it was the only meeting that I've ever picked a white chip at. I never picked up a white chip this time around because I was in treatment, so I never picked up another white chip besides that one. I picked up a white chip. That was August 23rd, 2010. I still remember it because it was a big freaking deal for somebody like me. I detoxed just cold turkey, old school style, didn't sleep for about 2 weeks, hung around the clubhouse, went to a meeting every single day, sometimes twice a day, sometimes three times a day, because I was so physically sick the first 2 weeks and hadn't slept. If I wasn't around people and at meetings and just hearing and listening and just being with people who just seemed to care about me, I wouldn't have made it. It was truly an act of God that I even made it then. It is a power greater than myself, because any other day, any other time, I tried to detox. I couldn't tell you how many times I tried to detox myself, and I wasn't, but at that point in time, I was able to do it, and it was not of me. I'm very clear about that today. I got a sponsor, and unfortunately, she was very young, and she was not grounded in the work. She just wasn't grounded in the big book, and it's not her fault. It's not her fault that she wasn't grounded in the big book. That's just what it looks like from time to time. You see it all the time, you know, and God bless them, you know, bless their little hearts. But she wasn't grounded in the big book. Honestly, never really looked through it. She always just had me read the 11th step stuff. And I don't even think we ever really went through the book at all. From what I remember, we did a lot of talking. I wrote an inventory. I read a fifth step to her. And I was on my sixth or seventh step. And I had about 70 or so days sober. The boyfriend had come back into my life because he knew I had gotten sober. He had been sober at a treatment center. And everything seemed to be just freaking great. It seemed to be falling into place. I wasn't thinking about drinking or using. You know, everything was wonderful. And then, bam, the little bastard relapses. And because my sobriety, my everything was not rooted or grounded in a power greater than myself. It was rooted and grounded in him, you know. And when somebody fails you and you are absolutely invested and your life is invested in that person and your being, any of it, your happiness, anything, and that person fails you and you have nothing else, I mean, what do you think, you know? 2 days later, I used. He relapsed on October 30th, and on November 1st, I relapsed. And when Lindsay took me through the book, and I literally, you know, in terms of a first step, in terms of powerlessness and really being able to identify it, because a lot of time you hear people say, like, I chose to do this or I chose to do that and, you know, what have you. The truth is that morning, no part of me when I woke up was like, you know what, today I'm going to shoot dope. I'm going to shoot dope today. I've had this many days sober. I got through a hellish detox and I'm going to shoot dope today. I got in the car. I wanted to go pick him up and I wanted to take him to a meeting. The first half of that ride, I'm taking him to a meeting. The thought, You read it in the big book all the time and all the stories, and Jim and, you know, Fred, any of their stories. The thought came into my mind that maybe I could just use once. Just once. I'll use once. And a few thoughts came. I'll just use once and I won't tell anybody. No, that's not going to work. That's not going to work, exactly. I'll use once and then I'll go pick up a white chip later tonight. You know. Because that sounds great. Y'all, I'm not that type of heroin addict. I'm sorry. I'm not that type of, that's not the way that I am. I'm somebody that once I start, I can't tell you when I'm going to stop. And once that obsession kicks in, I'm done for. And it kicked in. It kicked in and I was done for. There was no calling my sponsor. You know, there was no thinking. It was the thought, I was being driven. You know, I'm behind the wheel, but I really ain't the one driving the car. You know, something else is driving it, and I used. And 4 days later, I actually overdosed. It didn't have to go to the hospital, and then the very next day, on the very same stuff, I overdosed again, and this time was woken up by paramedics. I never had that happen. Taken to North Fulton Hospital, and when I tell you, I said, I will never do this again. I'll never do it again. I meant it, and if you hooked a lie detector up, I would have passed. I'll never do it again. Did it again the very next day. And I did it again until the end of the month. Until I was driving my car and I had stolen, or I had conned my dad out of money. I didn't actually steal it from him. I just slightly lied about what I needed it for. So I had the money. I left the house and, what it was like for somebody like me is that I'm dishonest. I take what I want when I want it. I will lie, cheat, steal. I will do anything I possibly can. I will make you think things that aren't true by any means. I will look my mother in my face when she confronts me about using stuff, and I will absolutely be able to convince her otherwise. I will actually make her feel bad for confronting me about using. Actually make my own mother feel bad about confronting me about using. That's what it was like. I'm completely driven. I'm completely trapped. I don't know what else to do. Any time that any form of consequence or confrontation comes up about my substance use, I deny, 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 deny. I denied every single time. Every single time denied about it. Every single time. My dad called me when I had gotten about 5 minutes away from the house, and every other day of my life, I tell you, every other day of my life, I would have just ignored the phone call, and it wasn't even a hesitation. My finger clicked to answer. I picked up the phone, and I knew what he was going to say, and he said, are you using? And for the first time, seriously for the first time, pure honesty came out of my mouth. Yes, just honesty, raw, told him everything. He asked me to come home, and I told him that I couldn't. I told him that I was going to go use and that I would come home once I was done. And I meant it. He begged me, why are you, like, you know, and I literally, at that moment in time, that was grace. It was grace. Grace had entered my life, and the delusion, because that's what I'm naturally inclined to do. It says my natural state of being is restless, irritable, and discontent. But my natural, the way my mind works, what I do, why I do this work is that I'm facing a disease that constantly wants me to believe that my delusion is true. I can be somewhat of a delusional person, you know? And the delusion was smashed and reality sunk in. And I was awake to reality. And the reality is that I'm powerless over drugs and alcohol, and that my life is completely unmanageable, and that I have no earthly idea how I'm not going to wake up tomorrow and not use. I have no clue. And I know I'll do it. So my parents got me help. They sent me to treatment. They sent me to a treatment center in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. It was a Scientology treatment center. But the truth is, y'all, is like they called some sort of hotline and, you know, they knew I had been in the 12-step program and that I'd relapsed, and they're desperate. They really are. You know, they're absolutely desperate and they don't know what to do and they just want to save their daughter's life. And it served its purpose. It got me distance and it got me time. That's what it served its purpose for. And I was in a space, to be honest with you, that I was so beaten down that when I knew it was a Scientology place and still went. And the truth is if my parents would have taken me to a shack and the person at the front door said, look, you're going to come sit in the shack and all you're going to eat is dirt for 6 months for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But we promise you that when you're done with this program, you will no longer drink or use alcohol. I would have done it. I would have done it. I was talking in a meeting the other night. I guess I was leading discussion, and I was just talking about, because it really is, it's like a reflection, like, piece. Like, just the utter, just, like, simplicity of being a desperate newcomer. Like, it seems so simple because all I'm trying to do at that point in time is just not use or drink. That's all I'm trying to do. That's where my focus is. It's like when they say the minute by minute, you know, the hour by hour, the day by day, or whatever. I'm just trying not to do that. Like, that's all I want to put. So let's just not do that. Then we'll start to look at the other stuff. But at the time, I really didn't think there was other stuff to look at, you know. Forget the fact that when I was in treatment that I huffed on Freon, and that's slightly frowned upon. And I said my sobriety date was December 3rd for like the first 2.5 years of my sobriety until I did steps again and was like, Lindsay, so I don't think my sobriety date's December 3rd, girl. And she's like, what? And I like told her what happened. I was like, I don't know. Like, I'm not sure. And she's like, girl, just pray about it. See what comes. I prayed about it, and February 1st is the date that came in my prayers. And, you know, that's what it is, what I believe is my sobriety date. But it's just I relate that experience to Bill's story, you know. Bill had a first step experience. He still drank after his first step experience. You know, he admitted that you know, the self-pity and the just like the quicksand wrapping around him in every direction. He was beat. Alcohol was his master. You know, I had admitted that. But because I did none of the internal stuff, I love in the first step where it says I'm powerless, dash, and my life is unmanageable. It doesn't say that my life is unmanageable because of alcohol. No, my life is unmanageable. I am an unmanageable person. Me. You take alcohol and drugs away from somebody like me, and I am unmanageable. My thoughts, my actions are the most ridiculous, absurd things. I mean, some of the stuff that I did in the first few years of my recovery are absolutely absurd. They're absurd, you know? But that's the thing. That's the evolution. That's the beauty of this process is you see people come in. And in my own experience, I came in and I really did. I truly believe that alcohol and drugs were my problem. And I realized today that they were just the solution. I mean, they were a solution. You hear people say it all the time. I'm the problem. I am the problem. The way I think, the way I feel is a problem a lot of times. Because the way that I feel will drive me to behave in ways that are just absolutely not what link up with my morals, values, and principles for living life today. I'm not a dishonest woman. You know, I'm a woman of integrity. You know, I do the things that I say I'm going to do. I show up on time. I'm loyal to people. You know, I have these principles in my life. You know, I'm giving. I'm there to listen to people and not just constantly talk about myself. Although, honestly, I have talked a lot about myself the past couple days. And, you know, but my girls get it. You know, they get it. I'm here to be of service to individuals, to see what I can bring to life and not constantly just take. That's the type of woman that I am. And when I'm living out of this ego, when that unmanageable piece and it's not being addressed, and that's what the steps do. The steps address that. I sometimes wish they wouldn't, but I mean, they do. I was saying that the other day. I was like, man, if I would have known coming in here, like what you actually have to do, and that's what I mean, that you come in and all you care about is just not drinking and using. Like you come in with that desperation. It's such a beautiful thing because you just don't care what the process is going to look like. And I think it's so beautiful when people come in here and it really breaks my heart to see the people that have been in the program and have had time and know what it looks like I really see like it deter them because they just don't, they're not interested in having to go through that process again because we're familiar with it. When you're not familiar with it and somebody tells you to do something, you just do it because your very life at that point in time, it depends on it. My life depends on it today. I do this because my very life depends on it. And I am so blessed, honestly, that in the 5 years of some of the hell that I've gone through, of some of the hell that I've caused, that I've always remained very connected to that. I'm powerless, and my life depends on this. And I come to meetings, and I stay accountable to women, and I do these things so I can connect with a power that's greater than myself and continuously connect to something that's ever-changing, ever-evolving, and ever-growing. And for some reason, I honestly believe or something that my life would be better if, like, things just stayed the same all the time. I get stuck with that a lot. If it just stayed like this, then it would be fine. That's not even true for me. If things stayed the same all the time, I would still be a hostess at Fleming's, and I wouldn't today. I'm a marketer for a multi-million dollar healthcare company. I mean, if I stayed the same, there would none of this would have ever been experienced, you know. And I got out of treatment, and I started going to meetings again, and I hooked up with Lindsay. The amazing thing, and I always get emotional when I talk about it because I'm just like, this woman is just unbelievable, and I'm going to try not to get emotional, but Lindsay was placed in my life, she was placed in my life by something divine, honestly. I wasn't looking. It wasn't anything along those lines. It's like literally everything. I come home from treatment and somebody brings up Lindsay's name and says I should call her. And I'm just kind of like, I don't know. And then I go to a meeting and she's there that she never goes to. She just happened to go to hear somebody speak. And then I go to another meeting that she never goes to. She just went because I think somebody was a discussion leader that she knew. And it just, like, all of these signs, and I asked her to be my sponsor, and she took me through the big book. She took me through line by line. I am not somebody who does very well with people telling me what to do. I don't really care for that. I feel like I'm a pretty independent woman, you know, even though my experience up until that point proved that I was really not that great at doing anything on my own. But when Lindsay told me these are the things that you're going to need to do for me to take you through the work, there was no hesitation. I did them. And at the time, the lineage that she was with, I mean, this bitch wasn't playing around. I mean, it was, you sit in the front row, you have your big book, you open your big book when we go through things so people know that this is what the program of action is. You don't raise your hand. You have nothing of value to share. You know, you wait until you work all 12 steps. You go up, you thank the discussion leader and the chair person after every meeting. You call me at this time every single day, and if you don't call me, you better call me before that time. We meet once a week, and for whatever reason, and I don't even know if she still does this. I really don't know if she still does this. She took me to a meeting every single day, and I had a car. It wasn't like I was carless. She would meet me at a meeting every single day. She did. That just occurred to me. You did.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know why. You know. I don't know why either. She had me go to big book studies. She was doing a big book study with Jerry at the time. I went on Monday nights. I went to the Biscayne Room when Gene was doing it at the Biscayne Room, and then I went to Glumlot when it was Christian and it was Larry. I went to a women's big. I went to 4 big book studies a week. I had to go to a meeting every single day. And I was flexible. I had plenty of time on my hands, you know. I didn't have a job or anything. And I went to a meeting every single day, and she took me through all 12 steps in 60 days. And it was unbelievable, an unbelievable process that she was able to do that. And I'm forever grateful for it. And from then on, I've been able to work the steps a few times, sometimes balked at it. But, you know, for me, what is of value, because I see, like, just the disturbances that my mind can create within me sometimes, and then it affect my external environment, I like to work the steps once a year. You know, I like to be able to take a look at those things. You know, when I look at, like, what it really truly was like, and, you know, we talk about this stuff a lot too, because a lot of times we've been joking about it a lot recently. It's like when people say, you know, I'm so grateful to be an alcoholic because if I wasn't an alcoholic, I wouldn't have been able to like find this design of living. And I'm like, man, 2 days ago, I like literally said this to somebody. I was like, that's when like I don't agree with that statement. I don't necessarily agree with that statement currently because this is painful. My natural way of handling things is to avoid pain at all costs. Avoid it at all costs. However, I got to avoid pain, whether it's lying, whether it's stealing, lying by omission, whether it's, you know, putting on a happy face and pretending that nothing is just completely devastating me, you know, whether it's keeping my mouth shut, whether it's not telling the people around me that, like, no, I'm not really doing that okay, but I need you to think that I am because I'm a woman in the, you know, Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've worked all 12 steps, so I really shouldn't have any problems today, you know? Like, I've carried that belief system for a long time, and, I mean, the truth is that, you know, I have to be honest. I have to be authentic with people. I have to be able to tell people what's going on with me, and I have to be able to live this way of life, you know, regardless of what's happening. You know, today, I am, and that's the thing where it says that, like, the grateful, I'm grateful because the truth is the other day I was not, and everything in me wanted to take it to a dark place. And the beauty of the experience that I had the other day was the knowledge and knowing, and like really just like knowing in my internal being, in terms of like, I could take this really dark. I don't even have the power to do that today. Just like I'm powerless over drugs and alcohol, I don't have the power to take it dark. I don't. My connection with my higher power, when things like this happen, when life happens and it causes pain, one of the best things that I've heard recently in the past year, when one of my buddies picked up a chip, is he said, this year was one of the most painful years of my life and it drove me closer to God. You know, today, my pain, I've been restored to sanity. 10-step promises, my favorite promises. Love the 10-step promises. First time I heard the 10-step promises, I was like, oh my God, they just said that the obsession will be removed and I will be restored to sanity. And when I look at restored to sanity, it's not just in terms of the obsession of drinking or using, it's that I don't act insane when things happen to me today that are unfavorable to me. I don't punch people in the face. I don't cuss people out. I may think these things, but I don't act on them. My actions are sane today. They are sane. I don't behave in crazy ways. I don't do those things to people anymore. And quite frankly, because I've tapped into this power as a result of working the 12 steps, you know, God's the one who takes care of these things. It's not me. I know it's not me. You know, I remember first year of sobriety, I called Lindsay, and like I had been having an issue with a woman for a very long time over a guy, you know, and I called her and I was like, dude, I'm so excited. Like, she just like really ripped me a new one through text message. And I was like, you know, she called me every name in the book and I didn't respond. I just didn't respond to the girl. And I was like, I can't believe I did it. And Lindsay was like, hold up, girl. What makes you think for a second that you had anything to do with that? You know, anything to do with it. I am so blessed that you guys had me come speak tonight. I hope I made some sense. I don't know if I did. I'm so blessed that some of my best girlfriends are here to support me. And I love you guys. Thank you.